This is Pure Decking for Thursday, August the 8th, 2013. I'm Morps. This is the show about the most depressing news stories documenting our decline into a police state that I could find. Tonight we have BSV, RU, and Suave on the panel. I'm drinking a Killian's, because that's what was in the refrigerator that I'm not saving for Let's Get Drunk tomorrow. BSV, what do you got?
Unfortunately, I just have water, but I'm still recovering from illness.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Are you drinking anything fantastic?
A large bucket of black coffee.
Comes in bucket from the bucket.
Yeah. As I've explained before, man, my little espresso pot says makes 1 to 10 espressos. No, it makes one. One full cup to the top of espresso.
Yeah, I would be doing more caffeine drinks on the show, except for the time of the show. Maybe during Gen Con, I'll be like, and I'm on my fifth Red Bull and vodka. Let's see here. Suave, what do you got, man?
I am drinking Kilkenny Irish Cream.
Oh, la-dee-da.
Nice. So, a little bit of station news. I don't know if anybody's paying any attention or not. Next week, we're probably going to be at Gen Con, I think. Maybe. Assuming we're all sober enough to make it out of the hotel.
And the airplane. TSA doesn't decide to hold us up.
That's going to be a fun conversation. Sir, why are you carrying a Batleth with you? So.
Oh, at least we'll know definitely if we're on a watch list. There'll be certain of us turned around at the border.
It's like, sir, we're going to need you to turn around and don't be too shocked. Enjoy your freedom, Fondle.
We'll have to ask you to come over to this containment area. Hey, why is everybody else from the show here?
Hey, guys, I thought we were meeting up at the hotel.
Hey, I'm personally looking forward to going through the TSA. I haven't been touched since I broke up with my girlfriend. It's due.
Just ask them to warm up their hands for you first.
I've got backup plans. If I do get stopped at LA, I then will fly to Canada and cross the border there.
All right. So, of course, don't believe we're going to have any more shows after Let's Get Drunk tomorrow night. Lore could make a liar out of me on that one, but I think he said he was taking a little hiatus as well. So, I'm fairly certain we're not going to have any more live shows until Gen Con. We're definitely not having IHN on Saturday. So,
by then, I would have been awake for close to 40 hours.
Oh, that would make the show more interesting.
I'm not going to say it's not going to happen, but at the moment it's definitely not happening. It may happen, it may not. It probably definitely won't, though.
Yeah, I'm not planning on it. So, this will be interesting. If nothing else, we'll all be in one place, so we'll have to make sure we have at least one core member of the station not at Gen Con, just in case the snipers show up. Like, you know, the one guy they always make stay behind in the bunker.
Is there anyone not coming this time, though?
Anthony's not coming. There's a couple people.
Static.
Yeah, Static's not coming.
Okay, yeah. I see your main regulars on shows, you know.
Yeah.
Every regular's coming in.
For Anthony and Static. Oh, Static. I guess Anthony's not semi-regular.
Either way.
Yep, it'll be interesting. So,
stay tuned for the 3-hour marathon episode of I Have Nothing live.
You mean Drunken Debauchery?
Drunken Debauchery, and if it's anything like the last one, somebody will be hanging onto a wall.
You mean we aren't going to just do a complete live thing during the meetup?
Well, the only reason it goes 3 hours because me and Suave need to take breaks every 15 minutes for smokes.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. Or terrifying and you know, they pay for many therapists, you know, drinks. So
tattoo removal.
Yeah, there you go. It's like, so why exactly did you get a poorly drawn tattoo of, anyways.
I only found that one on my ass 9 months after I got back. And if anyone knows how they got there, contact me, Galaxy 15 Radio.
Yeah, actually, that wasn't a tattoo. That was a brand, and we're not talking about that. So, anyways, moving on. There's a little bit of buzz about Tor getting hacked, apparently. But it wasn't Tor itself. It was one of the hosting providers that hosted, like, I don't know, half of Tor.
Yeah, I think they estimated called around 50%.
Something like that. I think it was like a third of Tor, third to half of Tor's, what they call hidden servers, were run off this one company called Freedom Hosting. And it was shut down or hacked. And they're fairly certain the guy who runs the thing was arrested about a week ago now. Every page that was hosted on a Freedom Hosting server now comes up with a some kind of a vague error message and actually has a JavaScript payload in place that attempts to circumvent the Tor communication tunnel and tries to induce your machine. I believe it's a DNS request, a name request. It tries to get it to make outside of Tor so they can correlate the Tor IP and port to your real IP. So trying to break the anonymity of Tor, right?
Yeah, and it's like, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
I was just going to say, it's a very simple payload from what I understand. Really, all it does is it hops on your system and then attempts to send, your MAC address or something like that to address in Virginia?
Well, they initially thought that it was an NSA-owned IP. But now they're saying they're not so sure. And the reason I didn't want to just read a story on this, I wanted to actually talk about it, is because I've got in the show notes, I've got a couple of bullet points here, but in what I'm going to post on the page, I've got like four different stories that all explain different aspects of this, and most of them contradict. So I'm having a hell of a time sorting out what's real and what's not. The main theory that the reason the guy was arrested, who ran Freedom Hosting, is because he would not filter or remove sites that had child porn on them. And so because he wouldn't do that, apparently he was arrested and everything on the host was replaced with this malware page. But this is not the first time Freedom Hosting has been hacked. Anonymous did it back in 2011. So I don't know if this is maybe something that was left over, but the prevailing theory for most people right now is that the NSA or the FBI did this. But I found a story this morning, and the slug quote of the story was, the researcher said means one of two things. First possibility is that we simply is they're saying the IP address they have now doesn't match an NSA-owned IP like it initially did.
Right.
And the slug line is, we read the Robotech's report wrong early Monday morning, everyone, or that the data was somehow changed between Monday morning and noon. So when other people started looking at the data and questioning the researchers' assessments that it was an NSA-owned IP, because it was initially announced that it was NSA, then they said it wasn't. But later on in the article, they mentioned that nobody thought to take a screenshot or save the log. So
I call bullshit on that.
Yeah, there's bullshit on so many levels of this.
Real question is, who else would be doing it? And why would they want to identify those who are accessing these sites?
Just somebody who wants to prove that Tor isn't as safe as they think it is.
Right, but wouldn't it make more sense to put something a little bit more malicious than something that just sends your MAC address to somebody?
Blackmail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I feel like if you really wanted to really show that, you know, Tor is insecure or something like that, you had some vendetta or something, you'd do something more extreme than something that just sends a MAC address.
True.
It might just be IP. I can't remember what it sends, but it is a very simple piece.
the thing is, very simple, quick little one packets like that are easy as hell to miss. So there's, if you're trying to stay below the radar, especially for like a blackmail purpose, hiding your thing in an error page and having just that one packet go out means that you're probably going to go under the radar for a while until somebody really starts looking at what's going on.
Well, I don't know about a while. Wasn't it like 12 hours or something before it was reported?
2 days.
Oh, really? For a full 2 days, hey?
It was 2 days. Well, everybody knew something was up right away, but nobody figured out nobody figured out what the malware was doing for about 2 days.
Okay.
So, but the thing is, I guess we should explain. You'd get this bogus error page, and it would try to run some JavaScript in a couple of iframes, and it was bouncing data between the two iframes in your browser. I think that's how it was breaking the sandbox of JavaScript, and then it would send out this one packet. And this one packet was, you know, an identifier for your machine. I think it was IP. And they made it look like a DNS request, right? And if I'm remembering the read-up right, because I've been over several articles now and I could be remembering something wrong, but it only affected the Windows version of Firefox in an older Tor bundle. I imagine a lot of people were still using that, but... it didn't affect anybody on any other operating system. So if you were using Tails, like every time I talk about Tor, I always say just use Tails, don't use anything else. But I've actually got a different write-up for a Digital Dojo I'm getting on Tor later. But you know, if you were using Windows and this particular version of the Tor browser bundle, you were vulnerable to this malware. But if you were on OS X or Linux, you were not vulnerable. And if you're using Tails or the Cubes VM rig up for getting on Tor, you were probably fine. Or if you're using some, like if you had put together your own Tor package using a more modern browser than the one that comes in the Tor browser bundle, you were probably fine, because this is a problem Firefox fixed a while back. So it's odd the way they went after it, you know what I mean? But there's some interesting fallout from all this. One, you have a lot of people go, oh my God, Tor was hacked. Well, no, Tor wasn't hacked. Several services that run on Tor were hacked. It's sort of like saying, you know, oh, a web page got defaced. Somebody hacked the internet. I mean, you know. No, you're exaggerating a little bit. Now, Tor is a smaller community. So when that many of its servers go down, yeah, you might as well say Tor was hacked. But the other big issue about this was this Freedom Hosting ran a lot of legitimate services besides, you know, just whatever random page people were putting up on them and a whole bunch of Tor exit nodes, right?
Oh yeah, it's mega upload all over again.
Yeah, well, Tor Mail was running on it. You know, the Tor email service, there was a couple of banking things that were running on it. I was part of Silk Road running on it? I honestly don't remember.
No, from what I understand, okay. Silk Road is... they're doing their own thing.
They're doing their own? Okay. Well, I didn't know, because I've seen it several ways. So, but the Tor project themselves now say don't use Windows. They're literally have an article out saying, yeah, just don't use Windows. But they have updated the Tor browser bundle so that the vulnerable version of Firefox has been patched. And like I said, I just say if you're going to get on Tor for anything, use Tails. Because one, it's Linux, and there's a lot less malware for Linux. There's malware for Linux, but there's at least a lot less of it with Tails. And two, if something does get in Tails, it's not persistent. It doesn't, you know, you reboot and it's gone. It doesn't save anything. So, you know, if you ever get twitchy using Tails, just, you know, unplug it, throw the flash drive away, and make a new one, right? So, I mean... I don't know. I don't get on Tor very often. I really don't, just because I'll be perfectly honest, I don't have much use for it. I don't find much value in it. It's interesting as a concept, and I enjoy talking about it, and I enjoy the concepts behind it. But personally, I'm not on it that much. I occasionally route a network scan through it just so I don't get an IP blacklisted, but that's about it.
You know, it's got its uses. You know, it's specifically, like, especially for places where, are really concerned about their government watching them and being like, you know, political dissidents and stuff like that. Like, it's got its place. But I'd say the vast majority of its traffic is strictly just like illegal uses, like full on like kiddie porn, drugs, men, all that sort of crap.
That's the majority. I think that's a good third to a half, but I think most of it is wannabe badasses. People I'm cool because I use Tor. I mean, seriously, not to make fun of those kind of people. It's cool and all, and I think we need a layer of that. We need to have it needs to exist in case you need to get in it, right, for anything, or if you ever want to, you know, have a way that you know is being anonymous. But at the same time, I imagine a lot of the use of Tor is really just people doing it to do it, you know, for the shit and giggle of it.
Well, that's why I did it. Did it once for a couple of days and meh.
Yeah.
There's nothing there unless you're looking to buy dope or fucking child porn. Or guns. Even that was quite difficult to find.
Yeah, too, most of that stuff looks the damn sketchy. It's just like, you know, I could try this, but I'd just be throwing my money away.
Yeah.
It's like, this is somebody who's just going to take my money and disappear onto the internet. So,
like, it's like a holiday in a third world country. Go there, but double bag it, you know, or don't even attempt to fornicate with the natives. Because you're only risking it, okay? But go, have a look at the sites, take in the view. No, you'll go once, you'll probably never go back.
It's pretty entertaining. Like, you know, it's not that difficult to avoid the kiddie porn. You just don't go to any porn sites, and you're generally fine.
Last time I was on it, it was so much better than the initial couple times I was on it. Where the initial couple times, you go through, you know, you hit a forum or, you know, a board or something just to see what's there, and damn it. I mean, but last couple of times I've been on it, it was so much better because they had some indexes up. And, you know, a lot of the links were clearly labeled. So it's just like, you know, I don't want to see that. Fantastic. There's a link I know not to click. So in some of the anarchist and, you know, political forums are really funny to read on there.
They are. The racist ones are great. The Stormfront shit and crap like that. Absolutely hilarious.
Also, all of the fake assassins on there. Because really... You know, I'm sure there's a couple of real hitmen on there, but I bet you the vast majority of them are completely bogus. And they're just people who want to get their hands on, like, 100 bitcoins for nothing.
That or they're law enforcement baiting.
Yeah.
You know, freaking entrapment, but,
Is Canada so boring I can hear the crickets tonight, man?
Possibly.
All right. So, Tor itself is not broken. Several of its servers are. So, when I get to Digital Dojo, I'm going to be talking about Hoonix, which is another Linux distro for getting into Tor. I'll talk about that a lot more when we get down there. But their wiki, I should point out, is fantastic reading, even if you're not going to use their Linux distro, because they have all kinds of good, a lot of it's common sense, but a lot of really good information of how to be anonymous on the internet, what Tor can and cannot do for you, and just, it's a fantastic write-up. It's really worth your time to go peruse their wiki for a bit. It really is. So, and I'll get into that more later. Excuse me. Let's go ahead and move into current events, other stuff I got. It's all kind of news, I guess, so, but these are less explanation and more just poking fun and laughing. So, first one up is from The Guardian. A British-based computer scientist has been banned from publishing an academic paper revealing the secret codes used to start luxury cars, including Porsche, Audi, Bentley, and Lamborghinis, as it could lead to the theft of millions of vehicles, a judge has ruled. The High Court imposed an injunction on the University of Birmingham's Flavio Garcia, a lecturer in computer science who has cracked the security system by discovering the unique algorithm that allows the car to verify the identity of the ignition key. So he's essentially figured out how they make the numbers that are burned into the chip in the little computer chip in your key. The UK injunction is an interim step in a case launched by Volkswagen's parent, which owns four luxury Marquette against Garcia and two other cryptographic experts from a Dutch university. So these cryptographic experts cracked these car codes, and the car manufacturers are suing them. It complained that the publication could allow someone, especially a sophisticated criminal gang with the right tools, to break the security and steal a car, because, you know, they don't do that already. The cars are protected by a system called Megamos Crypto, an algorithm which works out the codes that are sent between the key and the car. The scientists wanted to publish the paper at the well-respected Usenix Security Symposium in Washington, D.C. in August, but the court has imposed an interim injunction. Volkswagen has asked the scientists to publish a redacted version of the paper, dismantling Megamos Crypto, wirelessly lockpicking a vehicle immobilizers without the codes, but they declined. So in other words, it's like they were saying, yeah, publish this, but don't tell people actually how to do it. And these guys obviously wanted to show off their work, which you can't do without, you know, showing the proof, right? Volkswagen told the court that the technology they examined was used in a number of its vehicles and other mass market cars manufactured by itself and others. Garcia and his colleagues from the, Stichting Katholieke, did I say that right? Catholic University, Bears Edge and Rolvoet. Verdut, I don't know how to say these names. They said they were responsible, legitimate academics doing responsible, legitimate academic work, and their aim was to improve security for everybody, not to give criminals a helping hand at hacking into high-end cars that can cost their owners 250,000 euros. They agreed that the public... Oh, I'm sorry, that's pounds. Yeah. You'd think I'd be better at recognizing my international symbols by now, right? They argued that the public has a right to see weakness in security on what they or the security in which they rely exposed. Otherwise, the industry and criminals know security is weak, and the public do not. So, I'm going to stop reading there. Pretty much, the court sided with the car manufacturers that no, you can't publish this. So, I don't know. I don't like the courts telling anybody they can't publish academic work, especially in the computer security field.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's good for security because it tells people, hey, this is a vulnerability and needs to be addressed, instead of, hey, we'll just not publish this, and then the next person who finds it, well, it might use it for nefarious purposes instead of for an academic paper. So yeah, it's definitely, especially because now people, this has been brought out into the media, people are aware of it. I guarantee you, give it like a
somebody
month,
somebody else has already found it,
and somebody's going to figure it out, and it's going to be published. It's probably not even going to be by the guys who found it initially. It's going to get out there.
The way it should have been done is, hey, Porsche over here. See this? How much do I get paid now? Well, don't let it out.
Yeah, how much are you paying me for my quality assessment consulting? and that's a valid point, though, is, you know, they could have just paid him off to go away. But they didn't. They sued him in court and told him to shut the hell up. And the judge agreed. And just as somebody who is involved in the security field professionally, this is terrifying to me that the courts are backing this. Because that's your leverage as a security researcher. You find a bug in something, you find a hole. The only way you have to ensure that the manufacturer might fix it, because if you just give them the information and walk away, They're not going to fix it. They have no incentive to fix it unless you've got somebody there who actually cares about the quality of their product, in which case they might fix it just to fix it. But if there's no leverage, if there's no threat there, a lot of times they're not going to spend the money to fix it. These cars are already out there. How many cars would they have to recall and update the security system in, which means new keys, all this other stuff, because this is published, right? They don't want to incur these costs. So they'd rather just, you know, plug their ears, say la la la, and pretend the hole doesn't exist.
And technically, if you're a Porsche owner now, you can sue Porsche when your car's stolen for not fixing a security problem.
Well, that might eventually come to be the case, because if you have no leverage to, you know, force the manufacturer to do something about it, of, you know, hey, generally the way this works in the software industry is you'll do something like, hey, I've found this problem in your software. Here's my proof of concept. Here's my code. And if I don't hear back from you in 6 months, I'm going to publish. You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, usually you'll hear, you know, the story is, anyways, usually you'll hear back from them, and, you know, within the amount of time, and then you can negotiate when you can release your research and all that other stuff. Because, two, it's also an academic thing. These guys' academic papers is how they're going to get future grants and jobs. That's how a lot of network security guys get hired, is they find holes and publish their work. So if the courts are going to start saying, no, you can't do this, you know, how do you recruit the best and the brightest of the network security guys when they can't publish their work, you know, for fear of law?
Yeah. Well, that was exactly the same with H5N1.
Yep.
One of the scientists created something. He accelerated the growth of it or something like that to where it would be transmittable from human to human, and wanted to post his results academic-wise. And the American government stepped in and said no. So they ended up taking it through court, and it was allowed to be published after that. Now, that was a very shortened version of what actually happened, but essentially that's what they were doing.
Yeah. So it's a scary precedent for me that they're doing this.
Mm.
So, all right, next story up. This one's from The Verge. Bitcoin's status as a form of unregulated virtual money doesn't mean it's not subject to U.S. currency laws, a federal district court has found. In a published decision from August the 6th, Judge Atmos Mazat ruled that the SEC's case against the alleged Bitcoin Ponzi scheme master could go forward. Trenton Shavers, the accused, had argued that the court didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute Bitcoin-related crimes under existing securities law. According to him, no money ever changed hands, just Bitcoins, which he asserted were not an actual currency. Mazat, however, disagreed. It is clear that Bitcoin can be used as money, he wrote. It can be used to purchase goods or services and, as Shaver stated, used to pay for individual living expenses. While only a limited number of places let you purchase your goods with Bitcoins, it can be exchanged like any other currency. Therefore, Bitcoin is a currency or form of money, and investors wishing to invest in Shaver's company provided an instrument of money, which means it's subject to U.S. regulation and law. This is good and bad. The court's decision adds to a growing body of policy and law that says Bitcoin is a currency. Earlier this year, U.S. Treasury Department's Jennifer Calvary called the companies that deal in Bitcoin and other virtual currencies a financial institution and said that the same obligations as any money services business. Later, a California court attempted to shut down the Bitcoin Foundation on grounds that it was operating an unlicensed money transaction or transmission business. Abroad, a Thai Bitcoin company was shut down after trying to get licensed as a currency, but not because the government disagreed with its assessment. Bitcoin was a kind of money. The Bank of Thailand agreed, but existing laws didn't provide a framework to correctly regulate it. So what this means is that governments are accepting that Bitcoin is a currency, and fraud and other crimes that normally apply to currency can be used with Bitcoin. So if somebody hacks your computer and steals your Bitcoin, that's theft of money and all the laws that apply to that. But the interesting, you know, flip side of that is that means companies that operate with Bitcoin, like, you know, transaction clearinghouses and brokers and that kind of stuff, they're subject to all the same financial regulations as the regular banks. And my understanding is complying with all those regulations is expensive as all hell.
Yeah, they'll kill them that way. That's how they'll kill Bitcoin off. No one can afford to do that.
Red tape and bureaucracy.
Yep. Red tape, bureaucracy, and tears.
Now you have to sign fill out the proper form for the tears.
I'm sorry, we only have 4 stamps on this form. It requires 5. You're going to have to shove those tears back into your tear ducts.
You know, I really just look at this as another one of those unenforceable laws. It's like, really, when you look at it, like, okay, sure, it's now a legal currency, and now it can be fully regulated and everything like that. Okay, yeah, that's going to cause... Oh, sorry, cracked a beer.
His blow-up doll just deflated.
It's definitely a slow night.
Well, no, it's those, the Kilkennys, they've got one of those CO2 canisters in them, so it foams it up when you open it. But anyways, what I was saying is, with Bitcoin, sure, you know, they can go ahead and say, oh yeah, you know, it's regulated, we can tell you what to do with it. But they can't enforce it in any way whatsoever. It's just another one of these kind of like useless laws that's not going to have any bearing on anything.
They can enforce it by lawsuit and
by well, they can enforce it by lawsuit on the currency exchanges. That's really the only place where they can hit it. All that's going to do is it's going to drive Bitcoin underground. And I've actually seen a large number of people where you actually have people buying Bitcoins with cash in person. Like, obviously, this isn't going to work in, like, rural communities, but, like, the city where I'm at, I actually know of a couple of different unofficial, like, Bitcoin traders, where if I want to get some Bitcoins, I can actually go send this guy a message, we'll go meet up at, like, a park somewhere, and I'll give him some cash for some Bitcoins. But it's just going to drive it underground. And then it's going to be completely, it's going to completely remove it from any method of, controlling it in any way whatsoever.
Anybody else just imagining Suave getting shanked in a park now?
This is like James Bond shit right here, right? And, you know, him leaving at midnight to meet some dude in a car park and smoking and shit. Hey, man, how many Bitcoin you want?
Well, I haven't actually had to do that because I don't need Bitcoins for anything. But I know it's possible.
So, I don't know.
And stealing the USB.
Shanked for the laptop. They later found the laptop sans hard drive in a park. You know, like apparently they bludgeoned him to death with his own laptop, stole the hard drive, and disappeared into the night.
It's coming.
That'd be awesome. I mean, how cyberpunk can you get, really? But I mean, on one hand, though, you know, a lot of people love to hate on the banks, but if you go look at how regulated they are, it is insane. And by declaring Bitcoin as a legal tender, it's a form of money, you're right. All the exchanges effectively are banks and have to follow the same regulations. So now that... It kind of swings both ways, because I know a lot of people like to hate on the banks and think they're not regulated enough, but they're still pretty damn regulated, especially for, like, you know, a one or two guy operation with a server and, you know, a couple of PayPal accounts to turn into a, you know, declare that as a bank. That's a the accounting work alone is crazy.
I feel like I should point out it's not that they're not regulated enough, it's that they're regulated wrongly. They have too much regulation in the wrong areas.
Now, that I agree with you on wholeheartedly.
You know, like, absolutely too much regulation. Yeah.
You overregulate and only the big boys stay in business, and then you have no competition. But that's a different argument. Let's move on to the next story, because I really don't want to talk about economics. I don't know about you. Do you guys want to talk about economics? Because I really don't.
Oh, no.
don't. I just thought I'd check.
You know, if somebody wants to get on the feedback form and wants a good economics discussion, you can talk to Madman, because he's a lot better at it than I am. So, let's see. Next one up, this one's just funny. It's from Washington Post. Former NSA and CIA Chief General Michael Hayden speculated on Tuesday that hackers and transparency groups would turn into cyber terror attacks if the United States captured NSA leaker Edward Snowden. He went on to dismiss Snowden's supporters as nihilist, anarchist, activist, LulzSec, anonymous. LulzSec worked for the CIA. Anonymous 20-somethings who haven't talked to the opposite sex in 5 or 6 years. You know, not to be blunt about it or anything. that probably wasn't the smartest thing to say, because the government desperately needs hackers, and usually when you desperately need somebody, implying that they're sex-starved, basement-dwelling, would-be terrorists isn't a good idea.
Did they actually say that?
General Michael Hayden, his quote is that he called Edward Snowden's supporters nihilists, anarchist, activist, LulzSec, anonymous, 20-somethings who haven't talked to the opposite sex in 5 or 6 years. That's the quote.
That's very specific.
It's only been like 2 months. Come on.
That, man, wow. What a douchebag.
And they wonder why they can't recruit all the, what do they call them, cyber warriors that they keep saying they want to hire? One, because I can't imagine anybody in the industry who would take themselves seriously if you called them a cyber warrior. Like, really? What video game are we playing? Is that like a Quake thing? But
I want to be a cyber warrior. My cyber sword.
That just sounds
dirty.
I've
read Snow Crash.
beer all over my computer.
Yeah, well, he's christened it. But yeah, it's you know, this article goes on with analysis and talking about how the government can't recruit people, but they really need to recruit people in that industry, and you know, just sitting there insulting them is not a good idea. So I just love the quote.
What do you do? Yeah, I'm a cyber warrior. Oh, so you're a virgin. That's cute.
So you're saying being an asshole to people isn't a good way of recruiting them.
Well, it depends on the people, right? You know your audience and all. But in this case, they're already on the fence. I mean, the videos floating around from Black Hat are hilarious. Of people heckling, government types.
Oh yeah,
like, we don't trust you now. That was fantastic. And just flat out yelling it at them. It's great. I love it.
But when it comes to like recruiting people, so yeah, sure. I think somebody actually went around and asked a bunch of people at DEF CON, you know, would they work for the NSA? And it was like a huge percentage. It was like 90% said no. But there's still that 10%. And let's say out of that 10%, 10% of those, so like 1% overall, actually knew what they were doing. 1% of all hackers is still a very large amount of people and more than enough for the NSA to be fully staffed by a very competent individual.
I think you might be overestimating the numbers a bit, but that might be true. But a lot of the people who said no, I don't believe they were quoting a number because, you know, if they come up and offer me 6 figures, fuck, you think I'm not going to take the job?
Yeah, and that's probably most situations. Sure, if they're in a survey, they're probably going to say no, but really, all it takes is some dollars.
Yeah, no, you offer them enough money, they'll come work for you. I mean, that's the truth.
Really, it's kind of badass. Like, sure, you know, you're helping the government put down the people, but just think of the power.
What's the quote? Better to be at the side of the devil than in his path? I mean,
and really, even if you are some sort of activist or something like that, and you're approached by the NSA, absolutely accept that job. You get on the inside, and sure, like don't go like sabotage things or commit crimes or anything like that. But at least you learn how they operate.
Just keep notes.
And, yeah, exactly.
Oh, so you can end up like Snowden.
No, don't. I said don't break any laws. You can do everything completely legally. But
there's absolutely nothing wrong with just keeping notes.
Yep. This raises the question now, if you do start working for a certain acronym, right, and you get to a level of skill set and you know so much shit, Are you ever allowed to leave?
Yeah, they'll just kill you.
No, just...
It's,
you gotta
it's
sign
a genuine
on
question, you know? I'm not... trying to take the piss or anything here.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so yeah, I know what you're saying. If you sign a non-disclosure
agreement.
Yeah, okay. Are they still going to trust you? That's all I worry about.
Well, you know, it's a good point. And if you do something like, you know, you try to pull a WikiLeaks or a Snowden or whatever, yeah, they're going to come after you, if nothing else, for violating your non-disclosure agreement, right? But, and, you know, of course, all the clearance policies and everything that goes with that. But all I'm saying is just take notes, just keep them handy, because you have to think, eventually, if what you're doing is so horrible, it's going to come out, right? It always does. It might be 10, 20 years down the line, but it always comes out. And if you've got the notes right there handy for the prosecutors, hey, you know, you can still be doing the right thing if you just have to wait on the legal system to catch up. That way you don't have to go to jail. So it's like, I'm sorry, sir. I know what I agreed to, but that's a subpoena. So
yeah, you say, well, Mr. President, it's about to come out. Send the freedom drones in to get rid of anybody who knows anything. Well, yeah. How many black eyes can they take now? Like, at the moment, the American government's got sunglasses on, and the tears are still coming down over the whole Snowden issue. They can't get hit in the head with another one.
Oh, that might be right. I mean, I honestly don't know how far these people are willing to go. I know they're willing to go pretty damn far, but I guess that would depend on who you ask. So,
yeah, that's all that would make me weary about. You know, signing up for a government position like that, where you're gonna know a lot of stuff.
But the thing is, you know, guys like Snowden and Manning, the story is, anyways, that they weren't really all that high up. It's just, apparently, once you get clearance, that just kind of opens the door to everything, and so
yes, there's a problem.
Yeah, that's called poor architecture. And whether you agree with what they did or not, the problem there is not your systems; it's your people.
Hmm.
So you can do proper architecture, you can do proper systems design. Good permission sets are handy. You know, technical limitations are fantastic for keeping people, you know, on task and what they're supposed to be dealing with. But at the end of the day, you know, how many people have clearance? It's like millions, or maybe not millions, but it's a lot.
Yeah,
it's several hundred thousand people have clearance to various levels. So, you know, there's going to be somebody in there, if you're doing something shady, who's going to be like, you know what? No. So, again, that's, you know, there's only, you can only keep a secret if two people know it and one of them's dead. I mean, yeah. So it's eventually all going to come out. It's just a question of how long is it going to take. So that's why I expect there's a ton of people, you know, in various three-letter government positions who are just keeping notes, waiting for that subpoena. So that when Congress or a court or whoever calls them up to ask, you know, so what was going on here, you know, they can give dates, times, and who told them to do what.
And I just go, I know nothing.
Anytime it hasn't been a problem in my current job, my last one, anytime somebody asked me to do something I didn't think was on the up and up, you guarantee, I had a little notebook with all that shit in it. Never had to use it. Kind of a shame, actually.
But I bet you still have that notebook.
No, it fire. Anyways,
that's your limitations is now over. Doesn't need it.
Yeah.
To be fair, though, with the government and like doing shady stuff, they've been doing shady stuff since day one. Thing is, if they did it 10, 20 years ago and it comes out today, nobody's gonna give a shit. I'm just
Nobody
looking
gives
at all
a
the
shit
query.
Now.
Well, yeah, exactly. But they give even less of a shit if it happened 10, 20 years ago. So, yeah, sure, you can sit on your notebook and wait for when things go down. And by that time, nobody gives a shit. The government doesn't even care. Go ahead, give them the information. You know, it's so far behind that it's just not even an issue anymore.
Well, if that's the case, pull a Rorschach and, you know, drop the notebook off somewhere right before you get killed. So... You know, make sure somebody's got a copy of it, that if they ever see the obit, just drop this off at, you know, whatever newspaper you trust. So
trust the newspaper.
That's cute.
I was making a reference to the end of Watchmen, but, you know, whatever. So let's see. Next story. This one is from Russia Today. Sharing a song on YouTube Sharing a song on YouTube could soon become a felony. The United States Department of Commerce is asking Congress to increase penalties for streaming copyrighted work, revising a provision of the failed Stop Online Piracy Act. Opposition from the likes of Google, Wikipedia, ACLU helped to stop SOPA from being passed in early 2012, but part of that bill could be back from the dead. According to a recent Commerce Department report, the office's Internet Policy Task Force is asking Congress to reconsider a section of SOPA that could heavily penalize people for uploading select content to streaming services. The Task Force latest report, Copyright Policy, Creativity, and Innovation in the Digital Economy, because these people know so much about that, pressures Congress to consider felony convictions for people caught streaming copyrighted songs, music, and movies. And some say such legislation would outlaw the practice of uploading homemade cover tunes to the World Wide Web. Under current law, streaming a copyrighted song or show is only a misdemeanor and is not regularly enforced. Should the task force have its way, though, reproducing or distributing such material on streaming sites would open the possibility of felony charges. Felony charges for watching a fucking YouTube video.
Oh. Wow. That's pretty impressive.
I don't even need to read the rest of this. That's it right there. We want, they've got quotes from people talking about how this is good, this is bad. Felony charges for watching something. That's damn near a thought crime.
So technically, in certain states, three videos downloaded, three felony charges, life.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's... seriously, it's like you have viewed unauthorized content, you know, what the fuck? How do you even police this, one? But two, I mean, okay, in a reasonable court of law, how the hell do you prove somebody watched something? Did you watch that video? No, sir. Well, we've got logs here that say you did. Wasn't me. It's like, whoa, it's your IP address.
The cat walked across the keyboard.
Yeah, I mean, what do you want? I mean, oh, hang on. Did I just... hold up for 1 second. The streaming box was acting up. Huh, hope that didn't hiccup too bad. Sorry about that. Had like a network hiccup there on the stream box. So, yeah, I mean... this, in my mind, this is a thought crime. It's like, you have viewed unauthorized content. I mean, how soon before they're installing the chips in your eyes, because we have to make sure that only you can decode content you've paid for?
Yeah. I just love the idea.
Unauthorized information in your brain. We have to remove it.
You know, we're going to use the thing that made some rat's tail twitch and just cut out memories. It's like, yeah, we've eliminated that movie and half your childhood. Have a nice day.
Yeah, a felony charge for copyright.
But what happens if you were just
violation.
In the room and somebody else was streaming it on their phone, right? You know, it's like, oh, I heard part of that song and I hadn't paid for it. I mean, where does this shit end?
It's mind-blowing that you could go to prison for life for watching a video. Dude, can you imagine being the guy, the first dude? So what are you in for? I committed 13 murders. I watched a Lady Gaga video 3 times, and I didn't pay for it.
I guarantee you the guy who committed murders is trying to get the hell away from you. Like, oh God, fuck, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
It hurts. It hurts my head so much.
So these people that get paid a disproportionate amount of money to create rule of law for the individual and the citizens that they govern sat down with straight faces and went, we'll make it a felony. Really? Tell me no one fucking burst out laughing when they said that.
I'm sure they did, and I'm sure it just didn't matter. All right.
Did this law pass?
No, it's just a recommendation they're making to Congress right now.
Oh, I could say it's going through Congress. It'll never make it out the other side. Nothing goes through that house anymore.
I hope. This is something that should not make it through Congress. So, I just, you know, one, it's unenforceable. Two, the precedent. If shit like this comes up, you might as well just shut down any streaming service where you're not. And if you accept user submitted content, you might as well just kill it now.
We get into that. You ordered the YouTube channel package. You ordered the Facebook package.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you want to upload? Yeah, you're going to need a license for that.
Yeah. Well, not even like the jail time and all that, but yeah. Well, pretty much I can see people, oh, you have felony charges on your record. We can't hire you now.
Oh, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
And there's, I don't know about where you live, but I know here you can't own a gun if you have a felony, or...
Yeah,
you can't own most guns. I think you can still own flintlock.
As long as the gun has never crossed state lines, you can own it. So if you made your own...
So there's a lot of other penalties that will go into effect, even if you don't even see jail.
Oh yeah, you'd also too, you lose your voting rights.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow.
Alright. Next one up, this is from Elliot Kimber's blog. It's been rewritten up in several places, but I went back to the original source. And I was going to read a couple of lines out of the original post, but it's really much easier to explain it. What this person has found is that Chrome, the web browser, when you do an import from any of the other browsers on your system, it's going to automatically import your saved passwords, and you don't get the option to turn this off. It's a checkbox in there, but it's grayed out, and you just don't get a choice. It's mandatory that it's going to import your saved passwords. And now for the really fun part. If you go to Chrome:// settings/passwords, you can see all of your saved passwords. And there's a little button next to every one of them saying show you the password. So anybody who gets access to your copy of Chrome, whether that's physically sitting down in front of your computer or, say, copying out your user profile by hacking into your computer, can dump out your passwords without having to punch in any kind of a master password or anything. And Chrome sucks in all your other browser's passwords anyways if you let it.
Wow.
Awesome.
Uninstall Chrome as we speak.
Don't save passwords. And this goes for any browser.
Yeah.
Don't save passwords in your web browser. Anybody who sits down at your computer is now you. So just don't do it. I like the interrogation of my computer going, are you really Morps, every once in a while. I think that's a good thing. Especially because I have friends who will Hasselhoff my desktop if I'm not looking. So I kind of like the... For those of you who don't know, that's setting the wallpaper to be David Hasselhoff, installing the David Hasselhoff Windows theme, and setting all your home pages and bookmarks to be the David Hasselhoff fan site. Apparently, they developed a script to do this quickly in a few places of employment that I'm aware of. So,
this is why you always lock your computer if you stand up from your desk, and have it auto-lock if you're inactive for so long.
And why you don't save passwords. Because I can only imagine the shit that would get out there if you had a saved Facebook password, and, oh, look, you get to explain to Grandma why you came out as a homosexual or something. Or, you know, other strange statements that people might make about you on Facebook. I'm not even making fun of homosexuals. I'm just saying that's awkward for somebody who's not, you know?
Yeah, Sod's been a victim of this a few times. Like,
gee,
the last...
I wonder who would do that to Sard.
Was it the last party he had? Or sort of talking to Fox on his computer? And yeah. Things are a little bit weird.
Like I said, don't save passwords. Now, Chrome is apparently bad at it, but I mean, if you go to poke around in Metasploit modules, there's lots of shit out there for dumping your passwords out of browsers. So just don't do it. If you're going to save your passwords, save them in something stronger. I recommend a TrueCrypt encrypted volume, personally, if you want something to save your passwords in. Really, the best thing to do, is if you have to save your passwords, is to save them in something that's not your main computer. And I don't mean your cell phone. If you want to keep a copy of them physically, like a note card in your wallet is not terrible, because if you lose your wallet, well, you're fucked anyways, right? But... you know, don't put it on the post-it note on your monitor or under your keyboard. Everyone knows to look there. You know, something you carry with you is not so bad. Maybe a flash drive on your keychain, that's not a bad idea if you need a place to save them. But just letting your browser keep them is a horrible idea. And passwords.xls is not a super secret file, especially when it's right on the desktop. I just want to point that out. So...
what about if it's labeled, these are definitely not passwords?
Yeah, Actually, I might not open that because I'd think that's somebody's malware. But, you know.
On my laptop's gonna. Yeah, I'm the same.
Actually, no. If you want to do it, save passwords in your browser, but make sure it's the browser you don't normally use, like install Safari or something, right? And, you know, put in all your saved passwords and make them fake accounts that if something tries to log in with this password, you get an alert just to let you know that somebody was trying to get into your stuff.
Put a folder on your desk labeled porn. Have something hideously malicious in there so it bricks the whole thing.
Right next to a little text file that said, made you look. Okay, next story up is from The Register. The blink element, a feature of early web browsers that made text blink on and off, has been banished from the latest version of Firefox. Yes. The element had already been removed from Internet Explorer and was never actually implemented in Chrome, and was ignored by most web browser makers because it never made it into W3C HTML spec. The W3C even went so far as to add a blink-killing requirements to its web accessibility guidelines. However, if you missed the blink tag, apparently somebody's put together a little patch on GitHub to put it back into Firefox, and there's an extension for Chrome that adds it back in.
Oh boy, who would do that? Why would you add that? But really, like,
I don't know.
My question is, when was the last time that you've seen a website with the blink tag?
I put one on a troll page.
Fair enough. Personally, I probably haven't seen one in at least 5 years. Except for that one, there's this one website out there that's just like, it's basically like a direct knockoff of like the early 90s websites. I'll cover. Yeah, I'll send a link. It's the definitive bad website.
I have put a blink and a marquee tag on a troll website, but I don't remember blink actually working, to be honest about it. So okay, I enjoyed that one. Next one up is from the University Herald, which, by the way, that site has these horrible video ads that play along its sidebar. And they don't stop. Like, you pause them, and it plays the next video. And oh, God, it was annoying. But they're advertising their own stuff, so it's not in any of the block lists, right? And you can block the... I eventually ended up blocking the subfolder because it was just annoying as hell. But, yeah, whoever thought it was a bright idea to put talking video ads on a website on the sidebar when you're trying to read their fucking articles, and more to the point, put two of them? Just, you know, needs to be thrown screaming from a helicopter. So, anyways. But this is from the University Herald. A team of scientists in South Korea have developed the most precise method ever used to insert DNA into cells. The method combines two high-tech laboratory techniques that allow researchers to precisely poke holes in the surface of a single cell with a high-powered femtosecond laser, and then gently tug a piece of DNA through it using optical tweezers, which draw on the who called it that? It's they're not tweezers. Which draw on the electromagnetic field of another laser. So they're using one laser to poke a hole, another one to make a little electromagnetic field to guide the DNA into the hole.
If they wanted to have it sound fancy, use a better word, like tractor beam.
Who the hell called it optical tweezers? I mean,
I think that's actually what they called it, like, when they first developed it. They wanted to shy away from the whole tractor beam because they wanted to make it sound serious and not like some horribly written, like, IO9 article.
The team's approach, which is a breakthrough in precision and the control of control at the single cell level, was published today in the Optical Society's open access journal Biomedical Optics Express. What is magical is that all of this happens for one cell, said Yonggu Lee. I may have said that wrong.
Don't do a CNN.
Professor. What'd you say?
Don't do a CNN.
Yeah. An associate professor with the School of Mechatronics. They have a School of Mechatronics. That is awesome.
That's pretty badass.
Say what?
Oh, that's pretty badass.
Yeah. At the Gwanggu Institute of Science and Technology in South Korea, And one of the researchers who carried out the study. Until today, gene transfection has been performed on a large scale quantity of agglomerate cells, and the outcome has been observed as a statistical average, and no observations have been made on individual cells. Common techniques to force DNA into cells have been clumsy or even violent, Lee said. For instance, researchers often use so-called gene guns to fire particles coated with strands of DNA known as plasmids at large populations of cells. Plasmids, BioShock. Alternatively, scientists may puncture the membrane of individual cells with lasers, then place the cells in a plasmid soup and just let the genes kind of diffuse into the perforated cells on their own. While either method can transfer some fraction of a population, or transfect is the word, some fraction of a population, researchers cannot control whether any individual cell will incorporate the desired genes, and large numbers of cells may be damaged or destroyed in the process. In the new study, researchers sought to safely transfect an individual cell. To manipulate the foreign DNA, scientists used optical tweezers, which essentially tweaks a laser beam whose electromagnetic field can grab a hold of and transport a plasmid-coated particle. The researchers first moved the particle to the surface of the cell membrane. Guided by the trapped particle, they then create a tiny pore in the cell membrane using the ultra-short laser pulse from a femtosecond laser. While another laser beam detects the exact location of the cell membrane, they then push the particle through the pore with the tweezers. Using this technique, the scientists were able to ease a microparticle right up to the pore of the membrane and drop it into the cell, like a golfer sinking an easy putt. Sure. Why not? To determine whether the method had succeeded, the researchers inserted plasmids carrying a gene that with codes for green fluorescent protein. Once inside the cell, the gene became active, and the cell's machinery began producing the protein. Researchers could then detect the green glow using a fluorescence microscope. They found approximately 1 in 6 of the cells they studied became transfected. So the rate's 1 out of 6. That's not terrible for this. This rate is lower than that it recorded for some other methods, but they are less precise and involve many cells at a time. Lee hopes the work will allow researchers to investigate the effects of transfection on individual cells, not just large populations. And with the new technique, you can put one gene into one cell, one gene into another cell, and none into a third, and you can study exactly how it works. Now, that's the whole reason I was interested in this. Because they can break it down to one cell at a time. They can actually try to figure out why 1 out of 6 is transfecting and figure out how to get that up to 100%, because you can observe the process on an individual cell level.
That is pretty cool. Really, for me, looking at this, this is only useful in a laboratory setting. You know, it's great for studying these sort of effects, but as far as any sort of gene therapy, like, what's the point of doing one cell at a time?
No. Yeah, this is a pure research project.
Yeah. But in that realm, that is amazing.
Go ahead, BSV.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, it's just a pure research tool, so it's a key to help us get to better gene therapy use elsewhere.
Or just plasmids out of BioShock, you know, you get the gene therapy and throw fireballs.
That too. But also,
I'm interested in that.
Just a side thing. Is it possible to get a doctorate in mechatronics?
I hope so. Just for the name alone, that's awesome. It sounds like a degree in manga, doesn't it? I mean, it's like you have to go read all this anime about large robots. I know I'm like misunderstanding and greatly simplifying the word, but come on.
I just want this
school jacket.
But you'll be on the sports team.
So, all right, let's go ahead and move on to Yo! Hadouken! I love how it sounds like some guy drops a hammer on his foot when we play that. So, anyways,
maybe we should change it to Yoga Fire.
Oh, that'd be funny. Just rip off all the Street Fighter sound effects.
On it.
So, oh, boy. Anyways, so for Digital Dojo, I already mentioned it a little bit earlier, Hunix. Hunix is an anonymous OS, and it's the sole purpose is to build a Linux virtual machine for accessing Tor. The slug from their website is, Hunix, I keep calling it WAPIX for some reason, but WAPIX was something else. Hunix is an operating system focused on anonymity, privacy, and security. It's based on the Tor Anonymity Network, Debian Linux, and is secured by isolation. DNS leaks are impossible, and not even malware with root privileges can find out the user's real IP address. Hunix consists of two parts. One runs solely Tor and acts as a gateway, which we call the Hunix gateway, and the other, which we call the Hunix workstation, is on a completely isolated network. Only connections to Tor are possible. So the short version of it is it's almost not one Linux distribution, it's two. And it's not a distribution like download a CD and install it or run a live like a USB key. It's virtual machines. That's really all they offer up to download is, you know, OVA images, which are VirtualBox images. So one virtual machine plays Tor Bridge, and the other one is your web browser. So unlike Tails, where the Tor software is running on a, Tails, the Tor software is running on the same system. So if something goes wrong with your system, like the malware that we talked about at the opening of the show, it can disclose real information about your system. Now Tails doesn't have a big problem with that because it's a Linux machine and it's fairly securely built. But if you're running the Tor bundle on a Windows box, well, you know, I'm just kind of asking for it really. But even if you were using a Windows box to access the Tor bridge from Hunix, if you got the malware in there, it couldn't reveal it because it doesn't know it. The Hunix workstation does not know your real IP address. The information is not there to disclose, and it cannot really get at it, assuming there's no holes in the virtual machine. So that is the one big assumption the software makes, is that VirtualBox won't disclose this information to the VM. And I did play around with this a little bit today. This is dead simple to get up and going. You download the two virtual machines, you start them, you set some passwords, and you're up and running. And that's it. It's literally import the OVA files, start them, you're done. It's a nice project. It really is. And the other nice difference with the Hunix versus Tails is the virtual machines are persistent. So with Tails, if you download something or you write a document or something, or hell, you know, your web browser history, that's all wiped out when you reboot the machine, right? It doesn't get saved anywhere. With Hunix, these virtual machines are persistent, so it's just like any other virtual machine. It'll save that crap, your web browsing history, any documents you write, any files you download, right? So, you know, if you're working on an extended project and you need to be able to save stuff, Hunix is probably a better choice. If you're just poking around and you don't want to keep logs, Tails is your better choice. And I still personally like Tails a little bit better, just because I don't like the idea of saving anything out of Tor, just because that seems like a bad idea. But if you need persistence, or you're wanting something a little bit different than Tails, Hunix is a nice setup. It really is. And you just drop it in VirtualBox. You can run it on anything. So, if nothing else, I said it earlier, you really need to go check their wiki. They have several really long write-ups on staying anonymous on the internet, going through Tor and not. They have a real long section on, they do a really good explanation of what Tor can protect you from and what it cannot. I really enjoy the write-up on there of why you should never log into Facebook or give out, you know, anything that uses your mobile number to authenticate while going through Tor. Like, they don't just say don't do it, they actually explain why. So their wiki is definitely worth pursuing, if nothing else, just for the information that's in there, from both a technical and a non-technical angle.
That actually sounds a lot more useful, especially for Bitcoin, for example. If you've got a persistent system, you don't have to deal with the hassle of restoring your wallet and resyncing with the Bitcoin.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like no, that. For stuff like that, I'm sure something like Hunix is a much more viable system than Tails. Like I said, I don't like the idea of saving anything out of Tor. That's why I like Tails. know, there's no web browsing history saved locally. There's no logs. There's nothing to go on. There's just a flash drive, and worst case scenario, you can throw the flash drive in the microwave and get a new one later because they're not that expensive. So, and I can tell you from personal experience, when you microwave a flash drive, it smells horrible. So,
next time you do that, can you video it?
I only put it in for like 5 seconds. It wasn't really all that impressive. I wasn't trying to start a fire. I was just trying to make sure you couldn't read the drive again. So, anyways, yeah, I'm all about destroying data if you don't want it to get out. You know, if the NSA had been doing that all along, they wouldn't have had this problem with Snowden, right? It's like, what are you keeping all these documents around for? These things are incriminating. That's why you shred them. No, nobody, just, you're just going to let that sit?
There's nothing more to be said, man.
All right. Well, that's really all I've got. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. We're going to have probably off and on live stuff from Gen Con when we all get there. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Probably do one at Gen Con. Maybe. I haven't actually decided. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays. Of course, I have nothing on Saturdays, and everything's pretty much on hiatus this next week, so, for the meetup. Of course, the Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the G15 sim on OS Grid, the feedback forum, the subreddit, and one of these days we'll get around to setting up a Minecraft server, I think. So, I don't think I forgot anything.
That's just IHN, and some of the shows in the next 30 days will be a little
spotty. So, all right, I'm hitting play on the music now.